Hello and welcome to episode number 204 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you. This has become normal. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm in Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. Hello!
Hello. We got a big podcast this week. We got a lot to get to.
Do we?
I mean, not anything that's happened recently, of course.
There's a lot of 2004 to get to.
2004 isn't going to remember itself. Let's start with what we're drinking this week. What do you have?
I am drinking from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Because Rainier was sold out at Fred Meyer. It is Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Okay, there you go. I picked up a variety of 22s a couple weeks ago, so I'm still going through those. And this week I have from our friends at No Lie Brewing in Spokane, the Born Ready Citrus IPA.
There we go.
Felt appropriate for a day that felt like spring. All right, well, once again, I think we should probably do this weekly. I think a virtual toast in order for our medical personnel on the front lines, first responders, everyone working in essential jobs, certainly those in supermarkets who are helping keep us supplied with beer like this, everybody who continues to go out so that we don't have to, a toast to all of you. Then also this week, the NFL announced its all-decade team for the 2010s, which included five Seahawks. Devin Hester, who of course you think of first as a Seahawk.
Seahawks legend, Devin Hester.
Marshawn Lynch, Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, and Bobby Wagner, the most players from any team, as well as Pete Carroll, one of two coaches on the all-decade team with Bill Belichick. The Seahawks had four players named to the 2000s all-decade team: Sean Alexander, Steve Hutchinson, Walter Jones, and Seahawks legend Edgerrin James. Two in the 1990s, those being Cortez Kennedy and returner Michael Bates, and two in the 1980s, Kenny Easley and Steve Largent.
There we go. We're getting better every decade.
I guess this doesn't technically count. There's at least one player I know made probably multiple all-decade teams who subsequently played for the Seahawks after those decades. And I guess that didn't come up because he didn't play for them in those decades. But we're going to talk about him later.
Jerry Rice is who we're talking about?
That is who I'm thinking of, yes.
He doesn't get counted as the 2000s?
I don't think he was on the all-decade for the 2000s, no.
Oh, because he was all-decade in the 90s, but didn't play on the team in the 90s.
Correct.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
All right, the other thing I wanted to do at the top here. The listener, Lukey Crowley, tagged us in one of these threads asking people to name four baseball players who meant a lot in your life. And sadly, Lukey was not around for the 90s like we were. So his list is kind of sad. Dustin Ackley, Mike Cameron, Franklin Gutierrez, and Mike Zanino.
Wow. Is that a joke list?
I don't think so. This is the Mariners. This is the 2010s Mariners. They did not
Mike Zanino?
So I think there is, do you have a list? Do you want to start?
I thought we were going to collaborate on a list together as
okay.
The Pelton Cast list.
Oh, that makes sense. Yes. All right. Well, Griffey and Edgar are obvious, right?
I don't think so at all.
What?
To me, the only obvious name was there's one name because it's not about like the most famous players, right? It's about players who matter to you.
Yes, you've been noted when we were discussing his Hall of Fame induction. You were like, Ken Griffey doesn't matter to us.
Honestly, he did not even cross my mind for this. I think it's maybe because I was looking
at your mind.
Well, I was looking at the players who people were listing, and it's more like this is a player who matters to me, but might not matter to the entire world in general. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, okay, there's an obvious name there, and he's the reason I brought this conversation up, because this is the right day to talk about Richie Amaral. And why he is my favorite baseball player of all time, which all relates back to precisely 27 years ago today.
Wow. You remember the exact day.
Well, there's a reason for this. So April 6, 1993, Mariners opening day. They're hosting the Toronto Blue Jays at the Kingdome. And it also happens to be our cousin David's birthday.
There we go.
Which is why I remember the specific date. So happy birthday to our cousin. So, like, this was when we were just all getting into the Mariners. And I don't even remember watching this game. Like, I didn't start paying attention to the Mariners that season until probably like a couple of weeks down the road. I definitely remember catching the end of the Chris Bosio no-hitter, which I think was in April. But so our cousin is watching this game on his birthday, and Richie Amarillo, who has unexpectedly won the starting second baseman job over the highly touted prospect Brett Boone during spring training.
There we go.
Hitting ninth in the order against the defending champion Blue Jays, who would go on to win their second consecutive championship that year, goes 3-for-4 with a pair of doubles off Jack Morris, two RBIs, scores a run as the Mariners dominate the Blue Jays 8-1 on opening day. And so therefore he became our cousin's favorite player, and I uncreatively just completely copied that.
Okay, so Rich Amarillo was so important to you. Let me list off some facts that I remember to this day about Rich Amarillo that I should have no business knowing.
Yes.
Same birthday as you, correct?
No. His birthday April is 1st? April 1st, yes.
Okay, April 1st. Yes, April Fool's Day birthday. I got another second guess.
Ken Griffey Sr. shares the same birthday as I do.
Second thing, from Oxnard, California?
No, Oxnard is Bobby Ayala.
Oh,
You're like 0-for-2 here.
Where is he from?
Visalia.
Oh, Visalia, California. Okay, here's one. Previous year, maybe 2 years before then, PCL champion in batting average.
That sounds right. I don't know if I specifically recall that. Hit 346 in 1991, yes, so I assume he was probably the PCL champion.
Number four of these things that I clearly don't remember that well, as well as I thought I did. Tied for Mariners record, 5 hits in 1 game.
I don't know if I know this one either.
Do you know anything about Rich Amarillo?
I know a decent amount about Rich Amarillo. I mean, my favorite Rich Amarillo trivia is, of course, the fact that he was sent down when the Mariners called up A-Rod.
He was the player who was sent down.
Yeah.
Wow.
They cleared room for, because he had been the starting second baseman that year, but committed a bunch of errors.
I don't want to see team records. I want to see individual records. Oh, Rayo Labanias broke that in 2004.
There you go.
Well, that information was definitely accurate until 2004. Which, look, if anything happened after 2004, I don't know about it. So.
Wait, does it specifically say that he broke Richie Amarillo's record?
No, but I'm pretty sure it was 5 at the time. And Rayo Labanias.
Oh, here we are.
Six,
here it is. May 18th, 93. Richie Amarillo tied a Mariners record with 5 hits.
There you go. There, I got one right.
That was right before your birthday.
Maybe I'm giving myself 2 right.
So I think the key is that, like, so many of my early AIM usernames and that sort of thing included 08 in them because of Richie Amarillo.
Of course.
It's also weird that I went with 08 and not just 8, but for some reason that was the play.
Okay. So we've got Rich Amarillo, no-brainer, right?
Yes.
Was there anybody else who came to mind for you?
Joey Cora.
Really? Joey Cora? Man, it's a tough one. I always kind of took a shrine to Alex Diaz.
See, Alex Diaz was competing with Amarillo for playing time, so not a fan.
But the one who, and this is not necessarily on the same level, but this isn't obvious. Like, let's put Griffey in there. Edgar, I'm a little bit more on the fence about. But for me, it's my favorite baseball player of all time, of course.
Manny Ramirez?
Manny Ramirez. And another one where I couldn't pinpoint exactly why I love Manny Ramirez, but I just do, and he was awesome. It was like the two best swings in baseball history to me were Griffey is an easy one. Everybody loves it. Manny Ramirez, he doesn't get the same kind of credit for it that Griffey gets. Like, you'll see a video all the time. We'll be just like Ken Griffey Jr.'s swing. Manny Ramirez, though, perfect swing. Like, in the mid-90s, I think it's 96 season. I mean, it's just raw stats-wise. We didn't know anything about advanced stats in 1996. Incredible season.
I'm going to bet Manny was still pretty good by the advanced stats.
I mean, he didn't play defense.
That in 96 went 309, 399 on base, 582 slugging.
What was the year? Was that his best year? I swear he had one year where he hit like three higher than 309.
I mean, his best year by war was 1999 in terms of batting war. That season he went 333, 442, 663, led the league in ops.
I was ahead of my time, so I kind of stopped caring about Manny once he joined the Red Sox. Although I guess he was still in the Indians that year. But he would also seem to, which this is ironic that I like him, he would always destroy the Mariners.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like there was something, I guess I was being contrarian at the time. Maybe I always hated the Mariners.
You were secretly rooting for the Yankees during the 95 ALDS. In 94, they started the season against the Mariners, and I guess that wasn't a good game. Those weren't good games for him. But they came to Seattle at some point that year, and I remember him having monster games.
He had that one game that we went to, and I was wearing an Indians hat in the Kingdom. Wow, I had not thought about this in a long time. Because I was an Indians fan, because I loved Albert Bell and Manny Ramirez.
He had a series that year where he went 5-for-8 with a home run against the Mariners. And this was, well, very early in his career before he was an established star.
And our, like, relatives, I don't know who the fuck this person was. Somebody who is related.
A relative of our uncles.
Yes, and uncle too. From Germany was there. And, like, he had, for whatever reason, like, we were, like, talking shit to each other. Or mid-90s 10-year-old talking shit to each other. And he was, like, cheering for the Mariners and I was cheering for the Indians. We were, like, giving each other shit about it at the time. And I'm pretty sure Manny Ramirez killed the Mariners in that game.
That sounds about right.
Another player who I feel like should be in consideration, and another future Indian, Omar Vizquel.
You think so? Even though he got traded so early?
Do you remember how devastated we were when Omar Vizquel got traded?
What I remember about that is, like, we heard a rumor from our uncle that he had gotten traded because...
Still pronounced uncle. It's a hard U.
Because that was how you learned about things in 1993. Like, you heard these random rumors and you were like, I have no idea if that's true. I have no way to prove it.
Yes.
And then he got traded, like, became official days later.
It was official days later?
That's my recollection of it.
But Scott knew about it before then?
I don't know.
Wow. Was Scott on Reddit or something? Like,
I don't remember the actual details of this.
He probably heard about it on sports radio or something like that.
I was going to say a different shortstop. I was going to say Luis Soho perhaps qualifies.
Oh, yeah. Man, I don't know. There's a lot of Mariners who sort of went through our lives in the 90s.
I mean, we know Mrs. Like, Fantasy Genius is going to say Ken Cloud.
Well, I think Ken Cloud is really up there for me, too. It just it burned really hot for a short period of time, the love for Ken Cloud. And it was really just a few starts. Oh, my God. Bob Wolcott, too.
Yeah. Bullet Bob Wolcott. Darren Bragg, I feel like, is pretty high on my list.
Definitely like Darren Bragg. You have that broken bat from Darren Bragg.
That is correct. That is still in my living room.
From what year was that?
That would have been probably 96 spring training.
There we go.
Possibly 97. One of those.
Been
those
in your living room for 24 years.
I've not been in this house. That
longer time. Than Lukey Crowley's been alive.
quite likely so, yes.
Man, there's no other one. Rich Amarillo is the only one where I'm like, yes, definitively, right?
Yeah.
And Griffey.
Yeah.
But I feel like it has to be like a player that meant more to us than they did to the world at large, if that makes sense.
I'm still not sure I see this as necessarily a criteria, but I mean, definitely like A-Rod to me has no business on this list.
I mean, A-Rod, I like A-Rod. Like, I have nothing against him, but I barely even remember him being a Mariner.
I mean, I definitely remember him being a Mariner, but...
This is Doc.
It's shockingly hard.
Can we actually pick four?
Okay, so we know we have Amaral, we have Griffey. Let's put Manram in there. And that fourth one is really tough.
I'm surprised you're not more pro Joey Cora.
I don't remember ever really caring that much about Joey Cora. I like Joey Cora.
I don't know about this tech.
I'm just being honest. I definitely liked Russell Davis. But man, just like...
I feel like I was a fan.
Obvious as like, yes, that person. I don't know. What is your gut tell you of this very important Twitter thing?
We could also say Randy Johnson. That's also a possibility.
Does Randy Johnson mean more to you than he means to anybody else, though?
Probably not.
Like, yes, we liked Randy Johnson, but I distinctly remember the year he was traded really being mad at Randy Johnson.
Possibly, yeah.
Ken Cloud means more to me than he means to the world at large.
All right, let's say Ken Cloud, I guess.
There we go. That's for Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Okay, with that question.
What
answered,
about George Glenatsis?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a name. With that answered, let's turn our attention to inducting a new member to the Peltoncast Hall of Fame presented by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci is the voice of the people, and so are we.
I suppose so. So it was time for our second and final this cycle inductee in the non-sports category. And you voted on this. And it was close, as we expected. There was definitely a lot of support for Almost Live, which got 36% of the vote. Wild Waves just 14%. But in the end, it was Blue Scholars. It had to be Blue Scholars getting half of the vote to join Rainier Beer in the Peltoncast Hall of Fame.
Could not be more excited for Blue Scholars. I mean, they're the voice you hear every time you listen to the Peltoncast, right?
People may not know.
You don't hear the sounds of Wild Waves when you listen to a Peltoncast, right? You hear Blue Scholars. And
I mean, if we could play the sounds of the bonsai slide, then maybe that would be an option.
The bonsai slide. Play the sounds of the Ring of Fire. That's me in sheer terror. But I do not think that I don't think Wild Waves is going into the Peltoncast Hall of Fame ever.
It's not looking great for Wild Waves.
This was not a good showing on their first time in the battle.
I like Almost Live's chances in 2021.
So Blue Scholars. As mentioned, their song Slick Watts, which really there was no better distillation of what this podcast is about than both Blue Scholars as we reminisce about the early 2000s. And then also that song, which is literally just rapping neighborhoods in the Seattle area and then Sonics players.
Yep, that's right up our alley.
It was like, there you go. It was that song was recorded to be the theme song for the Peltoncast until we get a cease and desist.
Which may come this week. Yeah. I mean, also appropriate that we discuss Blue Scholars this week because we're going to, again, remember 2004, and that was the year that Blue Scholars really broke on the Seattle music scene.
I mean, the debut record, what I call it, would be the self-titled, the first 10 songs, basically. So 2004, the self-titled record was released in 2004, and it was 10 tracks at the time, or I guess 11 tracks at the time, re-released in 2005 because it had become a Seattle classic at that point. Three new tracks were added. Each one of them was perfect of the three new tracks, and Blue Scholars had gotten quite a bit more notoriety in that time period. So my first introduction, 2004, and not to get into 2004 talk, but it sort of bleeds into it. I was listening to so much KXP in 2004. It was all that I listened to, right?
Yeah.
And they would play a few different tracks from the first Blue Scholar self-titled record. I think Freewheelin' was definitely a big one. And every time I'd hear it, I'd be like, what is this, right? Like, I hadn't really been that exposed to quote-unquote indie rap at the time. And it was like, whoa, this is music. This is hip-hop music that is like, it's different than mainstream rap music, right? It's a little bit more musical. The content is totally different. And also, I'm like, these people are talking about what I'm seeing around me, right? In a way that was not familiar when listening to Ja Rule and Ashanti.
Really, we're listening to so much Ja Rule and Ashanti. I mean, especially the next year, once you started going to UW, you probably the fact that so many of the songs were about the U District.
So, okay, so there was that CD, and I was like, okay, I'm going to buy the CD, right? And I was like, I'm going to go to Easy Street Records and buy the CD. But then I'd, like, gotten a win somehow that they were going to re-release the CD. And these two people who I was, like, were friends of my girlfriend's at the time, in Boulevard Park, I'll have you. They do not live that far from Jan's house in Boulevard Park. Mario and Michael Cordova had somehow become affiliated with Blue Scholars. I don't understand how any of this process went, but they had stacks upon stacks of the CD. And I remember going, driving to their house and picking one up and then putting it into my car CD player and listening to it nonstop, those tracks. And then, like, I had heard that it was being released. I remember emailing Gio and Sobzy. And being like, and they responded too. Like, that's the thing that was fucking wild. Was like, before then, it was probably my first ever interaction with a recording artist. Was emailing Gio and Sobzy about when they were going to re-release the Blue Scholars record. So in that time period, they did a KXP session, which they played the song The Ave. And I swear to God, the first time that I heard it, I was like, this is the perfect song. I was like... I was consumed in at this time period with the idea of going to UW, right? Like, I had no idea that actually going there wouldn't be that great. But the idea of getting into UW and going to UW was like, it was your all bet that against, I cared about.
Winning your bet against Jan that you wouldn't make it into UW.
Yeah, that's the good, great parenting. Thanks, Jan.
It was a motivational tool, I guess.
Uh-huh. She did not use it as a motivational tool. So... they re-released it in 2005, and they did a show at Easy Street Records. I will say Blue Scholars is almost certainly the group that I've seen the most live of any group ever. It's like, I don't know where the number is. It's in the 30s, though, definitely. And I mean, like, venues all throughout Seattle, like, small and large, up through seeing them on the main stage at Bumbershoot, right? Like, the everywhere that you could basically possibly see a group, I have seen Blue Scholars in Seattle. So Easy Street Records, it was the first ever time that I saw them. They played like three songs. We walked through. I had a poster for their album release show that was going to happen at Chop Suey, which was 21 plus, so I couldn't go. But I still have it signed, framed in my garage, the signed poster from that Blue Scholars show. And it was like, it just, all of it mattered at the time. It was like, this is a movement that's happening. One of the tracks on that, the song Life in Debt, Mrs. Fantasy Genius and I walked out of our wedding too after the ceremony or whatever. We walked, if that's, no, 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 we walked down the aisle to Life in Debt and walked out to International Players Anthem.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely remember that.
So, walked down the aisle in my wedding to a Blue Scholars song. That is how much I've cared about this group for so many years. So, time passes, still care an extreme amount. It was actually quite a long time before they, like, in between putting out music, before Bayani came out in 2007. And I had started working in music in 2007. I'd gotten an early version of Bayani from a friend of mine working at the Vera Project. And it was like, I had a fucking tip on the stock market. Or something. Like, the idea of getting this, I cared so much about hearing this album, and I got it before it came out. I was working as the hip-hop music director of the UW radio station, Rainy Dog Radio, yeah. For one quarter at the end of college. On the day it came out, I played the entire record in full. And it was like, this was the coolest fucking thing that I had ever done in my entire life. I swear to God, there were 50-plus people listening. Anyways,
nice.
You took way too long to laugh at that. But no, it was like that album was like, I thought that the first record, like the Blue Scholars and the re-release, especially the new tracks, like No Rest for the Weary, to me is up there, maybe top 10 favorite songs ever. But like Bayani, top to bottom, every single part of it spoke to me, right? When he sings Tilton Carlo Rossi back in the summer of 2000, wow. I was like, that was our 2006. You know, it was like, I was like, oh, fuck. You know? I was like, you're living my life right now. Every single part of it, like North by Northwest. In yeah. between there, they'd put out an EP, which had the song Southside Revival on it. And like, we, as people from the Southside, like, we're proud of being from the Southside. Look, the Southside that Gio is talking about might not have been Boulevard Park, Washington, right? But when he raps, you can hear the planes behind me. You can hear the planes going over behind my vocals. It's like, yeah, us too. We're right here. It's like, this is the South Side, you know? And it was like, these people, I was like, there are people rapping about things that are, they're right there, right? It felt like it was within our grasp to really understand what was going on. But it was big too. It didn't feel like it was like cheap or underproduced. It was like, this is a group that sounds good and feels national, you know?
Some great lyrics on here. Like the Mariners, never finished in last place like the Mariners for 3 years straight.
Yeah. It extended quite a bit longer than that.
Well, they, I don't think they finished last place all those years.
So Beyond, I mean, I listened to it over and over and over again. And this is definitely up there. We're going to talk about another record, which is like pretty, might be the most that I've ever listened to anything. But this is, I think Beyond, it would be hard if somebody was keeping a tally of music that I've listened to in my life, as far as like CDs, records, albums, front to back. Beyond has, it might be number one.
Nice.
And it was just like having a connection to them. But I feel like Blue Scholars always sort of felt like out of reach. You know what I mean? They felt like they were too big or too far away, in a good way though. Like, not like, if I would have been close personal friends with Gio or Sobzi, it would have been like, ah, you know, like, these are people that I know, right? It almost would have made them too human in a way.
Like your close, like, personal friend Macklemore?
Yeah, like, honestly, it's true. We're like, I feel I know Macklemore better than I know either of the members of Blue Scholars, right?
Yeah.
I have never had any of the members of Blue Scholars numbers in my phone. You know, like, I've never been that connected to the group. And that was a good thing. Whereas, like, there's just like, there, it was a little bit outside of my personal reach. And it was like, this is music for being our exact age in our exact place at the exact right time. So what Blue Scholars had for that period of time was, and even through like Cinematropolis, I think is another excellent album. Everything that they've done, I've cared so much about, all the way through Hood Famous Bake Shop, which Gio runs, which Gio's wife Shara runs with Gio. And it's like, even all the way down to the fucking ube cakes, right? Like,
oh, amazing.
I'm like,
I assume this is connected. The ube milkshake at Woody's, right?
Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
That's in collaboration with Hood Famous, right?
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
Who's the best Sonics player who, or like the most important Sonics player who isn't mentioned in the Slick Watts lyrics? This is now the question I'm posing.
I have to look them up.
I everyone I keep thinking actually turns out to be in there, so I'm not sure what the answer is. Is Rashard Lewis in here? I don't think Rashard is in here. That might be the answer.
I can tell you that Boulevard Park, and because South Park
did make it in, yes.
Okay, so Boulevard Park not being mentioned or Renton, it's like, okay, all right. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So close, but so far away, right? There's two hills in the city of Seattle and a valley in between, on the south side of the city of Seattle, and we're on the other hill.
Wait, they've got Deep Like the Drive from Renton to Shoreline, though.
It's Deep Like the Drive from Renton to Shoreline.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. The drive from Renton to Ballard is even farther. God. Sometimes West Seattle, too. Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, Blue Scholars, it was an obvious, they were an obvious choice. I'm glad they're in there. Also very 2004, one of my all-time favorite songs is the Inkwell Crashed Car Remix, Crashed Cop Car Remix, I should say, that was Blue Scholar's Time's Modest Mouse. And
the very listener, 2004.
The listener, Tyler Gardner, sent me that that file a few years ago, but sadly it seems to have not migrated to my current computer, and I can no longer play it on Spotify.
I'm typing it into YouTube as we speak.
It wasn't on it when we talked about it on the podcast at that point.
These all seem to be live. I swear this is available on the internet.
I don't think it is. Okay, there you go.
Blue Scholars, Inkwell Remix on YouTube.
All right, well, I'm going to listen to that now then.
Sort of like the Bay.
I'm actually not going to listen now. I'm going to continue the podcast as it turns out.
Anyway, Blue Scholars, a group that has been present in my life for weirdly almost two decades now. I remember at that same I think this was at the Easy Street signing. My girlfriend at the time bought a Blue Scholars t-shirt, which is in the font that's on the cover of the re-release of the record. Basically the like tagging Blue Scholars. It was like a white t-shirt on blue, very tasteful t-shirt, always liked it. And I remember she bought one, and for some reason I didn't, because I don't know, I was a fucking idiot. And I had a homemade Blue Scholars t-shirt, similar. I actually homemade a couple of Blue Scholars t-shirts, but really liked that one. Do you remember the Macklemore t-shirt that had the skyline on it from like 2006, 2005?
No.
Oh, man. You got to see what year Language of My World came out. I think that might have been 2005. We'll get there. Yeah, that came out in 2005.
We're going to get there very soon.
Released independently on January 1st, 2005. I don't know if that's right. I was at UW when it came out, though. Or at least when I bought it. Anyway. Very proud to inaugurate Blue Scholars into the Pelvicast Hall of Fame. Well-deserved. They were extremely important in me getting into music at all and into feeling a sense of pride about Seattle. Like, this podcast may not exist without Blue Scholars.
About, and they were early on this one, occupied Duwamish territory.
Yes. That's the same fucking thing. I'm like, yeah, we're right there, dog.
Yeah, we are
like
closer.
The Duwamish is right there.
We are closer to the Duwamish River. At least we grew up closer to the Duwamish River than they did. I literally ran next to it today.
Well, I think Gio grew up in Bremerton. It's definitely much closer to the Duwamish.
Wait, what do you mean?
You were much closer to the Duwamish.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
You could see the Duwamish from Graham and Grandpa's house.
It is true. So, we've got one last spot in the inaugural Peltoncast Hall of Fame, class of 2020. And the second and final spot in the sports category will be determined by your votes this week. Among these finalists, Griffey Baseball for Super Nintendo, Jermaine Kearse, and Brandon Royce. This one could go anyway. I don't even know how I'm going to vote yet.
It's Kearse Crew all the way. Come on.
Yeah, it's probably Kearse Crew.
This is... Jermaine Kearse is the Rich Amaral of the Seahawks.
It's even different. It's different, but sure.
Just one player, I'm saying, means more to you than he means to everybody else. Granted, Jermaine Kearse means a lot to a lot of Seahawks fans, but it's like Jermaine Kearse matters.
Well, he means some negative things to some Seahawks fans. They are not part of the Kearse crew. Okay, before we move on to Remembering 2004, I do want to ask, you went back to Pagliacci last weekend, right?
Yes.
What'd you get?
I got the, every week for Baby Fans Genius, double pepperoni, of course. So I got the, I told you I had to figure out how to say this word. Two pizzas, which normally would have sausage. I don't eat sausage, and I got pepperoni on them. So the fungi salsiccia.
Sounds right.
Which is... basically, it's typically sausage and mushrooms. Got it with the salumi spicy pepperoni and mushrooms. Excellent. And then the PSR. So that's pepperoni, sausage, ricotta, which perfect combination. Whomever at Pagliacci was just like, yo, throw some ricotta onto that meat pizza.
Oh, ricotta.
Brilliant stuff, right? Yeah. Ricotta is the perfect ingredient on any food. So I got that with with the S as salami instead of sausage.
Oh, you stuck with the S though. That's
you
got to
keep it S. It's not a PSR otherwise.
Yeah. All right. Well, outstanding. Is Pagliacci remains open for no contact delivery and minimal contact pickup. All right, now it's time. We've been teasing it. Let's remember 2004. So the most important thing that happened in 2004.
We have to get theme music to remember some years.
Yeah, we probably do. The most important thing that happened in 2004, a huge transaction, undoubtedly, the Sonics hiring me as a full-time employee.
Oh, God.
So this happened in like late July, a couple, you know, less than a couple months after I graduated UW. And then within 3 months had won a championship ring from the Storm and just figured, yeah, that just happens all the time, right? When you work for a team, that's how it works. Maybe not so much. The Storm kind of put it all together. As we mentioned last week, they didn't make the playoffs in 2003, had Subert hampered by the knee injury that was eventually going to acquire a microfracture. So despite Lauren Jackson's MVP season, didn't make the playoffs. But the next year, they get much more experience. They had Betty Lennox through the expansion, or the dispersal draft, I should say, of the Cleveland Rockers, who had folded after that season. She becomes the number three player on the team, ends up the MVP of the finals. Also traded for Cherise Sam and Janelle Burst from Minnesota using the lottery pick they got by missing the playoffs. And that core comes together second in the Western Conference, best point differential in the WNBA. Get a little bit of a break because LA, the number one seed, the team that had been to the finals three consecutive seasons and had won two championships in that span, losing to Detroit in 2003, they get knocked off in the first round by Sacramento, allowing the Storm to have home court advantage. Also memorable from that part of the playoffs, Sue Bird, in their second game of a sweep against Minnesota in the first round, breaks her nose for the first of what turned out to be several times and has surgery the day of Game 3 of the Western Conference Finals against Sacramento, comes back, plays great. I think she had like double-digit assists. Storm went on a huge run, like 18-0 or more in the second half of that game to pull away, clinch the finals, and then in front of full houses at Key Arena for both games two and games three of the finals, survive game two when Nikisha Sales of the Sun misses at the buzzer, a shot that would have won Connecticut the championship, and then get a comfortable win in game three for Seattle's first major pro sports championship in 25 years.
There we go. I ticked that one off on the Storm, whatever.
Bingo.
Bingo. Yeah, I was there.
There you go. Did you get any bingos?
I didn't get any bingos. No, being fired by the Storm was somehow not on there.
No. I somehow only got one bingo, which was...
A lot of the things were like pretty fan-centric.
Yes. I think this is attended games one or two of the 2018 WNBA Finals. Owned something signed by Sue Bird, which I have a Wheaties box that has all of the championship team from 2010 signatures on.
I just interviewed Sue Bird. It's okay.
It's true. Have photo with Doppler. Have a lot of photos with Doppler. And went to the championship parades. I'm 2 for 3 on that one. So that was my Storm bingo.
Yeah, I got fired for doing the train, of course.
So the other part of my job went pretty well, because the Sonics, after a disappointing 03-04 season and an offseason where basically the only thing that happened was they lost Brent Berry and drafted Robert Swift, who wasn't going to play at all, they came into the 2004-05 season with no expectations whatsoever.
When you say that transaction... And you're trading out Brent Berry for Big Bob Swift.
I mean, that wasn't like specifically a trade.
Better.
I guess the Danny Fortson was the big marquee addition.
That's what I was going to say. They didn't have Fortson before then.
The baddest man in pigtails. But expectations were not high. Nate McMillan came into that year in the final year of his contract as a lame duck. No expectation of an extension. The Sonics then lose their season opener in LA to the Clippers by 30 points.
Wow.
And you're like, oh, God, what is this season going to be like?
Were we at the David Pelton's house that night?
No, I watched that in some sort of terrible casino on Aurora Avenue. with Brian Robinson. It's my second consecutive year remembering watching it. This one I was actually successfully able to watch. And I have a distinct memory after that game. That was Brian Davis's first game as a sideline reporter for Fox Sports. And I asked him, so, you know, other than the outcome, how was the game? And he was like, well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? But the Sonics then went on to win their next 9 games and started 17-3 after sweeping 2 of the 3 Texas teams, the Spurs, who would go on to win the championship, and the Dallas Mavericks, who were also a quality team, in the first road trip I ever made as a member of the the Sonics, flying on the team plane, etc.
Wow.
Yeah. You're going to call that a name drop somehow.
You're name dropping a plane?
I had lunch with Calabra. I guess that's the name drop.
Oh, there we go.
And then got a win in Charlotte on New Year's Eve to finish 2004 at 22-6.
Wow, I do not remember that win in Charlotte on New Year's Eve at all.
You should remember it. Because
did we go bowling?
No, the bowling was 2005 New Year's Eve, I'm pretty sure. Look forward to discussing that. That day, we went to the Husky men's basketball game against Cal. They played on New Year's Eve in the afternoon.
What did we do after?
I don't know. I watched the Sonics game.
Did we? We might have stayed at Grandma and Grandpa's and drank.
That sounds right.
Okay.
So speaking of UW men's basketball.
Quickly, I mean, we'll talk more about that Sonics team.
In 05.
Next year at 05. But there was a lot of steam around this time period. I feel like this fall going into that spring in 2005, just like the world was just really fun, right? Like there was a lot of fun stuff happening. If you were paying attention to that Sonics team, it was like they were awesome and we liked them in a way that I didn't like a team since the Kemp Payton era.
Yeah.
Right? Like Danny Fortson.
I mean, probably the 98 team with Vin Baker.
I don't know. Like Danny Fortson, we cared about my girlfriend at the time, so we would go to the games. And I'm pretty sure this started this year. You had gotten seats, so you got good tickets, right?
Yes. That was the year I got team season tickets.
But we kept our season tickets in 208 at the time. And so what we would do is me and our cousin Chris and my girlfriend and Jan, all four of us would go to the games. And what we would do is we would trade at halftime. So I think typically me and Chris would sit the first half. And this is the insane thing to think about long term, more insane than anything that happened in sports or music in that year, is that I would go to these games with my girlfriend and she would sit with Jan and not me. To process that now is just like, how in the fuck did I get away with that? And I would sit with our cousin Chris, so we would sit in the first half in the 100 level tickets, and then at halftime move up to the 208 seats, right? And it was it was the perfect setup. Like, having that season with those players and those people around, you're just like, this is – everything was perfect about it, and she loved – my girlfriend loved Danny Fortson, was like in love with him. I think maybe that's how I got away with sitting with Chris every game. But like
– all the better for her to stare at Danny Fortson during the second half when she was down low.
And she was obsessed with Danny Fortson. He was a beast. He was tough as hell. Like, he was unlike – really any player that the Sonics had since, I don't know, Frank Burkowski or whatever. Like,
but there's not been a season really like Danny Fortson. He might have led the league in true shooting percentage. He was right up there. He obviously led the league in foul rate by a mile. Might have led the league in offensive rebound percentage. Like, just when Danny Fortson came on the court, shit was happening. Sometimes it was good. Sometimes it was bad shit. I think he may have gotten tossed from that game on New Year's Eve, if I recall correctly.
Oh, he was fiery. Like, Danny Fortson came in and was like, he was the reason the team was so good, right? Like,
I mean, it was the bench in general.
Like, well, who else was on the bench then? Did we have Reggie Evans coming off the bench, or was he starting?
Yeah, Reggie was starting.
With Jerome James. Those were your big men?
Those were your big men.
Oh, my
coming
God.
Coming off the bench, a young man I like to know is Vlade Radmanovic.
Oh, Vlade.
Antonio Daniels.
God, I loved Antonio Daniels.
And then Nick Collison is a rookie.
Man.
So that was a squad.
So like, were they you go starting back to the Luke as a rookie? Or is he just not
second
playing?
Year. He was in the second year. He was starting.
Weren't Luke and Nick drafted the same year?
But Nick had the shoulder surgery before.
Oh, so he sat out a season, I see. So the starting lineup, they managed to score points with the starting lineup. I mean, obviously.
Rashard Lewis. Those were a big factor.
It was a lot of weight on Rashard. I mean, there was a Hall of Famer in there and like a perennial All-Star. So, but
I also want to note that Luke Ridnour made, I guess it wasn't his first career start. He'd started a few games by this point. But on my birthday in 2004, playing against Steve Nash and the Mavericks, had 16 points on 8 of 11 shooting, 13 assists and at the end of his rookie season as the Sonics beat the Mavericks by 20 points.
There we go. But yeah, that team, Antonio Daniels and Danny Fortson, were like, and we loved Ray and Rashard, but like, Antonio Daniels and Danny Fortson, they were a revelation. They were the players who we felt like, and they kind of were. Like, obviously, Ray being healthy and Rashard sort of coming into his own were a huge deal in the start to 2004, but there was nobody who we cared about more than Danny Fortson. What was he like in person?
Do you remember this? I mean, two of my favorite Danny Fortson interview memories. Number one, I'm pretty sure I was there for this one. There was one time where he was asked whether he lifted weights, and he said, "If I lift weights, I don't fit through doors." And then the other one, I remember this early in training camp, someone was like, oh, this actually was an interview of Reggie Evans, I should say, about Danny Fortson. Or no, I guess it was, I forget exactly what it was, but someone was like, "Hey, I guess it was Danny, are you teaching Reggie Evans any tricks?" And he was like, "No, I'm learning them from Reggie Evans."
Yeah, he's grabbing some nuts.
Reggie was crafty. Danny Fortson, there was nothing crafty about him.
Did he end his career with the Sonics? Wow.
Fortson? Yeah, I mean, he barely played the next two seasons and then was out of the league.
It's kind of incredible looking back at it that in that year he only scored 7.5 points per game. Because I remember him being a factor.
He actually was ejected on New Year's Eve 2005, as it turns out.
Like, Danny Fortson only playing 62 games and scoring 7.5. Well, he put up 16.7 one year with Golden State. Look at Danny Fortson.
I mean, he was a big time player early in his career.
That season was just like, was he injured all the time? Man, he did not really come close to playing almost ever a full season.
682 true shooting percentage that season, 18.4 offensive rebound rate. And what was his fouls per 36? 9.1. Somehow he didn't lead the league. I don't know how that's possible.
Just an incredible season. I guess he just didn't play that many minutes. But when he was in, he made a difference.
Oh, for sure. Okay, now let's talk about UW men's basketball. Because they were back, baby. And it sure didn't look like it. Early in the 2003-04 season, they started the season 5-8. 0-5, lost their first five games in Pac-10 play. And then game number six, at Oregon State, they're down 16 with less than 11 minutes left in this game. Do you remember the Oregon State reserve who made 5 3-pointers in this game?
Oh, God. No, I wasn't paying attention at all at this point. This was before the Arizona game, right?
Yes. I remember watching this game with the famous Cousin Katie. But actually, I don't know. That doesn't actually make sense. Yeah.
Of course, there was a shitty Oregon State reserve who hit 5 threes in the game, though, because there just is always.
Angelo Sagarakis.
Sagarakis, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
If we would have had a Google Hangouts chat in 2005, you would have been, or 2004, you would have been fucking livid about these shots.
Because the Fox Sports announcers kept going on about what a great shooter Sagarakis was. He shot like 31.5% from three and then basically like never played the next two seasons. Nate Robinson makes a three at the end of regulation to tie it up. Huskies go to overtime, pull away there, beat Oregon State, and then go on, much like the Sonics had that run at the start of the 2004-05 season, won 12 of their next 14 games. The lone losses coming at UCLA and at North Carolina State in a kind of bizarre, in hindsight, mid-season non-conference game.
Julius Hodge, was he on that team?
Yes, he was.
We played them again next year, right? The next year?
It was a home-and-home, yes. They played in Seattle in 05-06.
I remember listening to the 2005 one.
The 2004 one was Nate Robinson had one of his best dunks in that game.
Really?
Yeah. It was like a put-back dunk in that one.
I remember sitting upstairs, because you weren't living at our house anymore, and I remember sitting upstairs watching TV and watching the scores. I don't know what the fuck I was watching. Seeing the scores go through, probably Frasier, seeing the scores go through at the bottom, and it was like UW, or I guess it was ESPN, so I had to be watching something on there, it being like UW, whatever, Arizona, whatever, and I was like, what just happened? I'm like, we beat who now?
Yeah.
Because that was a notable Arizona team, right?
They were in the top 10 at the time, had Channing Frye was on that team. Who else was on that team?
Who was a top 10 pick shortly thereafter.
They had five NBA players. Andre Iguodala was still on that team.
Oh, my God.
Hot Sauce, Hassan Adams, Salim Stoudemire, who was amazing, and Mustafa Shakur was the fifth NBA guy on that team.
Well, the next year was the year that Salim was so good,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or is that this year? No, I think that was the next year.
So the Huskies beat Arizona home and away during that stretch.
So insane.
And then the season finale, Stanford comes to town undefeated on the season, number one in the country. One of the things I distinctly remember, so this was my senior year at UW, and I'd had season tickets the entire time, obviously. And like it used to be just you'd roll up 5 minutes into the game and go sit in the dog pack in the sixth row, and it would be fine because no one came to the games. And that final weekend, the Cal game was the first time that I like had to get there early and just barely got a seat in the dog pack section. And I was like, wow, this is very different. And the end of the game, once the win is decided, everyone starts chanting, bring on Stanford or something like that. And that game, like people are lined up hours beforehand. So I was sitting up in the rafters for that one, which I sometimes went and sat there by choice, even when the...
It's always better in the rafters.
Yeah. That is still my favorite UW men's basketball game of all time.
There we go. They were number one.
Yeah. And it was just like, it's the start of a new era. There's never been a moment like this since I've been at UW. Maybe not ever.
We really expected to win. That's the crazy thing. Like, there was so much steam behind the program at the time, and everybody had rallied around. And the...
Yeah, I mean, we were so hot.
Going into that game, it was like, fuck Stanford. They're not going to beat us.
I mean, Stanford also was kind of fraudulent. They were 16th in the Sports Reference SRS that season. Ken Pom had them 12th.
Well, they ended up losing in the second round in Nevada that year, right?
At Key Arena. They lost two times all season, both in Seattle, both games I attended because Mom randomly got somehow tickets for that second round of NCAA tournament games on the Saturday, where both Stanford and Gonzaga got upset. Kirk Snyder got him.
Kirk Snyder.
Who later that year, when asked his weakness, would say... Exposure.
Yeah.
Oh, loved Kirk Snyder.
He was right.
So the Huskies beat Arizona again in the Pac-10 tournament semifinals before losing to Stanford in the final. And we weren't sure they were going to get an NCAA tournament spot at that point because of the fact that their overall record was still not great. They were 19-11. But they
would
ended
have been
up getting...
pretty insane not to have put them in. But yes, we were definitely nervous about it on Selection Sunday.
They were so hot that it was hard to keep them out. They end up getting a 9 seed and matching up with
UAB
in the first round. A team, Mike Anderson was at UAB. That was a really fun UAB team.
They had that dude with dreadlocks. I remember who had long dreadlocks.
I mean, I think they had multiple guys with dreadlocks because they had the Johnson twins, right? Or no, it was the Taylor twins. And then Squeaky Johnson, who later had a cup of coffee in the NBA.
Squeaky Johnson.
And
He sounds like an ABA player.
He 100% does. They beat the Huskies 102-100 in a thriller in the opening round of the NCAA tournament before beating Kentucky as the number one
seed.
They
went on to beat Kentucky?
Yeah. 76-75, reached the Sweet 16, and then lost by 26 to Kansas.
It was a devastating loss to UAB. Just having an end.
It wasn't
one of those
a devastating
things,
loss, though.
It was fun. Like, it was such a fun game playing against them, and it was exciting to be back in the tournament. But it's one of those things where you're just like...
Truly happy to be there.
It just sucks that it's over, you know? And you're like, what we just experienced was so fun.
Yeah. It's like your theory about, you know, you just want to win to keep the season going longer.
Yeah, we just wanted more basketball. So, But at the same time, it really felt like, I think we had this feeling at the time. I don't think this is retroactively assigning this to it. I think we had the feeling like this is going to be a program long term.
I mean, at least for the next few years, because I mean, the core of that team was so young. You know, there's
a poster that I think is still on the ceiling in my childhood bedroom. That there's no going back when you're running with the pack.
It's in my childhood bedroom, friend.
It's on the ceiling in mine. Maybe we had it both up.
Maybe you moved it.
Curtis Allen, though. he was the only real senior on that team.
Yeah. But the rest of the guys, I mean, you're starting, Roy was a sophomore. Jensen was he was also a sophomore, that's right, because he was part of that next team. Conroy was a junior. Bobby Jones was a junior. No, Bobby Jones was a sophomore. And Nate Robinson was also a sophomore.
It was 2 years. What did they do next year? The next year? I guess we'll talk about this in 2005. This was not the year they lost to UConn, though, right?
2 years later was when they lost to UConn.
What did they do in between?
They were the number one seed.
Oh, kill me.
We'll get to that when we get there.
They were the number one seed.
For now, let's talk about the Seattle Seahawks, who were NFC West champions.
Hello!
In 2004 at 9-7.
Huge.
A really lopsided year in favor of the AFC, where two 9-7 teams missed in the playoffs, where in the NFC, both wild cards were 8-8. So the Seahawks were going to make the playoffs either way, but they
managed
barely
to make up for
beat...
it with like two decades of superiority for the NFC after that.
Yeah. There was a long period of time where the NFC West was not very good to the Seahawks' favor. Barely beat a Falcons team playing then backup Matt Schaub at quarterback at home in the final game to clinch the division. The Falcons had already clinched the NFC South.
Mike Vick was the starter.
Vick played the first almost full first half. Falcons went up 17-7 in the game. And then the Seahawks took the lead, but then survived a two-point attempt with no time remaining on the clock.
Wow.
The Falcons had a Warwick Dunn run that came up just short.
Wow.
And just revered.
Warwick
I have no
Dunn.
Memory of this game.
That is gone. I paid attention this year, but that is definitely gone.
But I do remember the next week when they then hosted the Rams in the wild card game. The Rams, who had previously come into CenturyLink Field and erased like a three-touchdown half.
Yeah, that was one. So there was a Sonics game that night that I showed up too late. I was going to say it was obviously a Sunday night.
The Seahawks Rams game?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't a Sonics game. It was game two of the WNBA Finals.
That I was driving to?
Yeah, because that was played in October.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. So I was driving, I was listening to the game, or I was watching the Seahawks game, and I was like, this is over. I can go to the Sonics, or to the, I guess, the Storm game.
I remember I went at halftime and checked the score, because, like, I didn't have a computer with internet at that point in 2004. I subsequently did by Sonics season, but we hadn't figured it out yet. And so I went to, like, the computer in the media room to check the score at halftime. I was like, all right, Seahawks got this one. And it wasn't until hours later, much like you, that we found out they lost the game.
I was listening to it on the way and being like, it's all falling apart.
There's
like,
actually...
Ricky Prohl fucked us again. No, I think Torrey Hall had a good game.
My piece about the Storm winning the championship, I'm like, you know, this Seattle hasn't won a championship in so long, and they've got the history of always losing the big game. And so I went through like various examples of this, and for the Seahawks, I put just the Seahawks have last Sunday. So in this game, in the wild card game, Seahawks down 7 with 27 seconds left, faced 4th and 4 at the Rams 5, and a Matt Hass pass went through Bobby Engram's hands, which was kind of fitting for the entire season, where the Seahawks were number 2 in the NFL in drops, and that was kind of the big storyline about the team.
Yeah, that was the year we started caring about drops. That's all we cared about.
I wrote a Football Outsiders piece about drops because it was such a big deal.
It was a pretty good wide receiver core. It wasn't like the wide receivers in general were bad.
Well, Daryl Jackson was quite good. He was tied for 2nd in the NFL with 11 drops. But Corey Robinson, things started to fall apart there. He was suspended for 4 games for a substance abuse violation and then also missed 2 games for violation of team rules and still tied for 5th in the NFL with 10 drops. So that's why they had to trade for Jerry Rice, who was 41, I think, in his final season.
I didn't know, I realized that they traded for Jerry Rice. I didn't remember
Me
that.
Me neither. I assumed he had been a free agent, but it was a trade. Corn Robinson would not be back the next year when bigger things were in store.
What did the Seahawks trade for Jerry Rice?
Pro Football Reference just has it as, like, it must have been a conditional draft pick. They've just got it as an undisclosed 2004 draft pick.
And what team was he on?
The Oakland Raiders.
Okay, he was on the Raiders.
Because he only played for two games until that brief stretch for the Seahawks. Only the two Bay teams. So, Seahawks legend, Jerry Rice. UW football bottomed out for the first of two times.
This is their first bottoming out.
I think this actually is the worst UW football team, at least of our lifetimes. I can't say ever, but went 1-10 with their lone win coming over San Jose State. Their closest Pac-10 call was a 28-25 Apple Cup loss to Wazoo. Casey Paz took over for Cody Pickett, and it was not great.
Wow.
Do you remember we went to the opening game of this season? This was before...
I went to Bumbershoot right after. Absolutely. Zach Tuiasosopo had a long run.
Did he? The Fresno State game.
Yep.
And the Seahawks lost badly to Fresno State in a troubling sign of what was to come. The Seahawks, yeah, they would have beaten Fresno State.
That's all that I remember about it, is we got tickets randomly. This was the first – that was the first UW game that I went to. Really, not, it wasn't like it was – there was terrible talent on the team, but really the quarterback was so bad. They just really couldn't make up for it. But you look at it and you're like, these players aren't horrible, right?
No, in this game, Casey Paz went 18 of 39 for 183 yards and three interceptions.
When a school that's had pretty good quarterbacks basically our entire lives, having Casey Paz as your primary quarterback for an entire season is just like, how the fuck did that happen? But
yep.
I guess it happens. The next year was Stanbeck starting?
Yes.
Okay. Was he on the team this year?
Yes. He played off the bench at times. In that game, he went 1-5 with an interception.
Let me just read through to you a list here. There are actually a couple things that don't fit, but maybe more recently. I'm going to start in 1984. I could even go farther. We could go back all the way to Warren Moon. But yeah. Let's start with Hugh Millen, Chris Chandler, Kerry Conklin, Mark Brunell, Billy Joe Hobert, Mark Brunell, Damon Heward, Brock Heward, Marcus Tuiasosopo, Cody Pickett, Casey Paz, Isaiah Stanbeck, Jake Locker, this is the other one that doesn't really fit, Ronnie Fouch, Jake Locker, Keith Price, Siler Miles, Jake Browning, Jacob Eason. Like, all told, the starting quarterback for UW has been a good or NFL caliber player.
I mean, and Fouch was just a backup. Like, he was playing because Jake Locker was injured that season.
In 2008, yes.
Yeah.
So, like, going into the season, and honestly, like, okay, if you look at next career, NFL, 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 CFL, or whatever, most of them are NFL. In fact, there's a run from, I don't know, like, 1976 through Casey Paz, where every single one of the quarterbacks that the Huskies had went to the NFL. And really after that as well, you know, like Siler Miles didn't, but, and Keith Price never played in the NFL, but like these were NFL caliber players. And then just going into a year with Casey Paz, they weren't able to compete at that point, whether it was the firing of Rick Neuheisel or whatever happened, who knows, but like this was a terrible season with no hope at all.
And Keith Gilbertson was fired after the year and replaced by Tyrone Willingham. Boy, things did not get much better the next season. Oh, boy. Speaking of bottoming him out.
I feel like there was still a little bit of steam by the next year, though. Maybe not steam, but like there was some excitement around the program by the next year.
There was some reason for hope. Speaking of bottoming out, the Mariners, after having come close but missed the playoffs the previous 2 years, dropped to 63-99. In Edgar Martinez's final season. The two highlights that year, Ichiro's 262 hits broke George Sisler's single season record of 257.
I remember well.
I believe we may have played in the best of, episodes 101 through 200, a debate where you complained about how meaningless that record was.
I remember watching 63
and 99 team.
I watched it. We watched it at Grandma and Grandpa's house, and everybody was like fucking cheering and standing up. It's like, yeah, dog, great. You hit the most singles in a year ever on a shitty team. Congrats, bro.
Love Ichiro. Big shows to Ichiro. Also, that was the Bucky Jacobson year where he had nine home runs.
Wow. He got himself a radio career out of 2004.
In his only major league season. That's Seattle sports in 2004. Let's talk about music.
Pretty good year. I mean, by the time we get to 2005, everything's getting pretty good in Seattle sports. Speaking of pretty good years, though.
Oh, boy. The debut albums in 2004.
Do we want to talk about debut albums specifically?
Yeah, let's just go through those first.
Okay, what do we have?
We have The College Dropout.
Uh-huh, heard of it.
Yeah, young man's name was Kanye West. We have The Funeral.
Mm-hmm.
The Arcade Fire debut. We have Franz Ferdinand's self-titled debut. We have Hot Fuss from The Killers. And then Mad Villain with Mad Villainy.
Uh-huh. 2004. So, I was paying basically, like I mentioned, I was basically paying no attention to any mainstream hip hop by 2004. And I remember seeing Kanye West on, I'm pretty sure it was Regis and Kelly. It was over the summer, and he did Through the Wire. Because, like, the incredible thing about Kanye West is that who he, like, the whole story when he started, and I think this happens for a lot of artists, right? Like, Drake was on Degrassi or whatever. But, like, the story when he started has transformed so much over time to what we think of Kanye as now. Oh. And it was, like, confidence was definitely part of it, but, like, Kanye was the dude who got into the car accident. He rapped with his jaw wired shut.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Like,
through the wire?
That was who Kanye was. And it was like, there was also sort of like the college stuff and wearing the pink polos. But like, I was like, oh yeah, he's that car accident guy. And I remember him doing Through the Wire on Regis and Kelly or Kathy Lee at the time. And I was like, wait, this is actually awesome. And I got a burned CD of The College Dropout. I think we might have bought the CD at that Tower Records going out of business sale. That we talked about last week, which I'm pretty sure happened in 2004, that Tower Records by Key Arena was going out of sale or out of business. And I listened to that CD, the burn CD of The College Dropout. It was so much that it broke. Like, I listened to it over and over and over again. Every single lyric from that CD is burned into my soul in a way that, like, there are Kanye records that I like better, but there's definitely not a Kanye record that I know better than The College Dropout. And it was just like, this is all that I care about. And liking Kanye wasn't like, it wasn't a thing to define yourself by in 2004, you know? Like, it didn't mean anything. So I was just a CD that I liked, you know?
Yeah.
It was just like, I like this Kanye West CD and I think it's pretty revolutionary. But it wasn't like, I'm like a Kanye West stan or something. It was just an artist, and what Kanye meant transformed so much after that. But The College Dropout was pretty much, we've sort of been circling it, where I think a lot of these artists, like, yes, their debut record, but there was still, it takes years to get there, you know? And like Arcade Fire had an EP beforehand. Like, things were building up to this point. Kanye had been producing major, major songs, which he describes at the end of the CD in a long story, which you're just like, what is this? But also, I love it. You know? Like, the idea that you would have, like, a pretty long song of just Kanye talking and telling a story. You're like, that shit never happens, right? But it's fucking cool.
I still don't understand who this person was that Kanye was, like, complaining about, who was spending their entire life in school racking up diplomas.
I've been there. That's not what I'm talking about, though.
That's what I'm talking about.
About you're always so angry about this.
I'm not angry about it. I mean, I am angry. You know, I don't like skits.
You know that everything I want, I gotta wait a year. I totally feel that right now.
Wow.
We feel you, Kanye, in 2004.
Kanye truly ahead of his time.
We're right there with you. but this album, all the way down to the videos, like every single part of it. I remember, like, I was probably maybe my most atheist in 2004, and hearing, as you're wont to be, I guess, as a 19-year-old, and hearing Jesus Walks, like the storm that was happening inside of me when hearing that song, and just being like, fuck it, I give in. I'm like, you win, Kanye. This is yours. Anyway, College Dropout. So then Funeral by Arcade Fire. I remember KXP also was hammering Arcade Fire. Like, I'll give KXP credit. They
good decision.
They were on this one early. They played a Deck the Hall Ball. Not that Deck the Hall Ball. Oh my God, what was the KXP holiday show called? Not Deck the Hall Ball. It was like, man, I have to look this up. The KXP, like, winter shows. It was at Numo's. It wasn't like a big thing. And Arcade Fire headlined. And I swear to God, they were talking about that for so long after. Where, like, Arcade Fire puts on an incredible show, like we've seen. And there's this giant band on stage at the Numo's stage. Like, it must have been incredible. Another one that was 21 plus, so I couldn't go to. I was very pissed. Also that same year, pretty sure 21 plus, Dizzy Rascal and the Streets together at Numo's. And which in 2004 was an incredible show, but Arcade Fire playing at that KXP winter benefit show or whatever. Like, they talked about that for so long. And I sort of resisted Arcade Fire a little bit at the beginning. And now you listen to Funeral and, like, I think it came out in winter of that year. Was the exact release date?
No, I don't think so.
September 14th. So, to me, and I had no idea that they were from Montreal or whatever, but, like, when you listen to it now, you can hear, like, the snow on the ground and, like, 9 p.m., and it's cold, and you can just feel the streetlights on the snow on the ground. Like, the whole mood of it. And there's, like, 5 songs that are perfect songs. But the whole thing in general, just
5 songs that are perfect songs.
There's 5 songs that really stand out beyond everything else, right?
Yeah.
Like, the singles are perfect songs, basically every single one. I mean, we're talking about perfect songs. But in general, the whole thing, just the mood, and you're like, I've never been to Montreal before, but I can tell that this is what I've been outside in the winter when it has snowed, and you can see the, like, orange streetlights shining down on the fresh snow. That's what Funeral sounds like.
Okay.
And there are not that many albums that feel like a time of, like, a mood like that. Being able to, like, encapsulate that is huge. 2004 also in music, like, The Killers, I remember hearing, I barely listened to the end, but I remember hearing Somebody Told Me was the first single from that record. And to me, it was always, like, the biggest song. And then I, like, years later, I was like, wow, Mr. Brightside, sure is a popular song.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
I'm like, Eric Roberts, huh? Him. Never imagined it. But Somebody Told Me was always, like, the premiere song. Got it at Best Buy for $6.99, as I did with so many music at this time. There are so many albums at this time. And
so many music.
So many music.
I mean, this is such a fully formed album. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, top to bottom, every song. Brandon Flowers, like, listening to it now, there's some things that I don't think you can appreciate as a 19-year-old that when you can look back on, especially working in music, I'm like, Brandon Flowers is, like, a special artist as a singer. And hearing him sing, it's just like, God damn. Like, I don't think I fully grasped how good he was at that time. But also a band that was, like, glitzy. So I feel like 2004 was the time period that we started looking back a little bit more. It was like we had reached a
we
certain.
We wanted rock stars again?
Yeah, we'd reached a certain trend of, like, indie had sort of happened or whatever in rock music. And
I mean, it probably even goes back to grunge, right?
People wanted, like, rock music in the early 2000s, I think. And that's how bands like, I don't know what year The Darkness came out, but like how shit like that became popular. But it's like The Killers is kind of the best case scenario of it. It was like there's not really like a lot of depth to The Killers necessarily. They're from Vegas. Like you don't want that. But The Killers were like they were the perfect band for that moment when we needed a radio pop band to sound. And it was like a little bit electronic, you know, and there was like very 80s, colorful. It's fucking Vegas, right? I mean, the other one, another debut album, is
Black Keys.
No, I don't think Black Keys is their debut album. When I think Rubber Factory came out this year.
Yeah, it's definitely not their debut. Yeah.
But The Hold Steady and Almost Killed Me is one. Yeah, Rubber Factory came out in 2004. Where it was like, this is classic rock music, but it feels different. You know what I mean? Whereas like, it's classic rock music. It has riffs. It's heavy. It's rock and roll. It's drunken, but you're like, the voice is so unique and present where you're like, this is different than anything that I've heard before. And I feel like 2004 was really like an incredible year for that. I mean,
I think Franz Ferdinand definitely falls into that.
And definitely Franz Ferdinand. I mean, like Take Me Out and a little bit dancey. Like people were starting to feel comfortable. And I mean, the Arcade Fire, like they were dancey on those songs.
This is still such a good album. Such a tight album. 38 minutes. For Franz Ferdinand.
The self-titled Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah.
And they would never be as good after that.
No. I mean, I don't think The Killers, like, when you were young, is good, but that's definitely still by far their best album.
Hot Fuss?
Yeah.
Man, I don't know.
You don't think so?
What year did LCD Sound System come out? Oh, 2005. Okay.
Yeah.
Definitely we will get there next year, but it feels like a lot of these things were sort of the genesis for that. Like there'd gotten to be this little bit of like an element of people adding some cooler things into it, like a little bit dancey, a little bit throwback. Also the year of in 2004 rapping shit that just sounds good next to each other. The two greatest artists who care about how words sound, right? Not necessarily the content, but just thinking of like, how do these words sound aurally when you're listening to it? And that is MF Doom and my boy Cameron. Both put out their best albums in 2004. Purple Haze and Mad Villain drinking sake on the Suzuki we in Osaka paid, right? Like, you're just like, these dudes are obsessed with how words sound. Right? Like they don't care about the meaning or whatever necessarily, but like pushing the grounds of what rap music is musically, right?
I would definitely say Lil Jon was pushing the grounds of what is music.
But Lil Jon is he's not focused on how words sound together. That is what, like Cameron and MF Doom at that time, they're bending words. They're making words like you don't need to pronounce it the exact right way. Just make it sound good. And Mad Villain, I think MF Doom has been all over the place. Very strange career, but definitely reached the highest heights when he connected with Madlib and put out that album.
Can we talk about Lil Jon for a moment?
Well, let me get through a couple of these more albums. Or do we have to talk about... Well, let's talk about Lil Jon then, because it transitions to Chappelle's Show.
That's fair.
Modest Mouse became a thing in 2004.
Yeah.
When we heard...
Float On was everywhere.
When we heard Float On, things changed. I've gotten one ticket in my entire life. I got pulled over. And I maybe two. But I've gotten one ticket in my
entire... Is this when you were driving by SeaTac Airport?
Yeah. In my entire life. Wait. I've gotten one ticket in my entire life in SeaTac coming down from the Safeway. I had long hair at the time in 2004. Wow. I was probably wearing a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. No, I was probably wearing a homemade Kanye West t-shirt. and I was listening to music so loud in my car, blasting music in my car, that some punk ass cop pulled me over because I was having too good of a time and I was too youthful at the time. And do you want to know what I was listening to?
Were you listening to Float On?
I was listening to Float On. These kids and their heavy metal and their hip hop.
Sometimes life isn't okay.
God. But that, I didn't really pay attention to Modest Mouse before then, but like that album, I'm just like, The World at Large, the first second I heard that, the first song to me, I guess it's technically because there's horn intro before then, World at Large, one of the best first songs on any record ever. You're just like, again, just the feeling. Oh my God, that song. I say can't complain. Okay, a couple of other ones that came out in 2004, quickly.
Wait, but no, I got to talk about how Float On is responsible for one of my favorite tweets of all time.
Yes.
So in 2016, Mike Baker, then at the Seattle Times, now at the New York Times, where he's doing amazing coronavirus coverage.
Wow, Mike Baker? He was in the Seattle Times? I'm like, the guy from the coronavirus?
Yeah, we had him. Wow. Let him go. So he tweets a headline from the Seattle Times in 2016, Portland, Modest Mouse singer falls asleep, causes chain of car accidents involving a government truck and two Subarus. And then Walter Hickey, then at 538 now of something called Insider, says, is this the same fucking guy who backed his car into a cop car the other day? So good.
Oh my God. Okay, quickly. A couple of other things that came out in 2004 that really matter to me.
I don't know if any of this has been quickly, but okay.
A Grand Don't Come for Free by the Streets. Literally, that CD changed the way I was fancying myself quite a writer in 2004. And my community college writing classes were so completely influenced by the Streets at that time. I mean, I thought fucking Mike Skinner was the perfect artist. A Ghost Is Born, the Wilco album that came out, the sequel to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, which is secretly better than Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Yeah, I got to disagree with you there, Chief.
You're so wrong, boss. But
I listened to that last week. There's some tough parts of A Ghost Is Born, man.
What parts?
The parts that are just like ambient noise.
Oh my God, spiders and kid smoke? Theologians? They don't know nothing. Seven Swans by Sufjan, arguably the best Sufjan album. Definitely
the most underrated.
Well, and Sufjan, when before the maximalism of Come On, Feel the Illinois, where like this was Sufjan at his folk peak on Seven Swans, came out the same day as The Hold Steady Almost Killed Me happened. Like, these things are probably so much more relevant to me as somebody who was 19 in 2004, but I'm like, can you believe that those two came out of the same day? More Adventurous by Rilo Kiley. Leviathan. And as we transition to...
Ooh.
That's Leviathan by Mastodon. As we transition to... The Bumbershoot lineup of 2004, Drive-By Truckers and the Dirty South. Again, this group seems to not have ever meant anything to you, but like the Dirty South, they fucking hammered this on KXP. They would play it nonstop. Every single song on the Dirty South is perfect. And I'm kind of shocked how much I'm talking about Drive-By Truckers and Let's Remember Some Years, but like it is probably the last that I will, but like this, coupled with seeing Drive-By Truckers on not the mural stage, not the main stage, not the exhibition hall stage, the fucking stage that was like near the weird art thing, right, by the car toys. What would you even call that stage? It's not there anymore. They have not had a Bumbershoot in years.
It's not been there any times. I didn't go to Bumbershoot until very recently, so... This I missed out on quite a year in 2004.
Before you ever even went to Bumbershoot, in the fucking Chihuly Garden and Glass stage of Bumbershoot, Drive-By Truckers closing out that stage was... It is engraved in my soul seeing that. It's like the classic lineup, right? Patterson Hood, Mike Cooley, and Jason Isbell. And Jason Isbell throughout the show, like, I remember being transfixed, him and his wife at the time, Shauna Tucker, who played bass, just, you couldn't help but stare at him, right? Like, you're like, this is a fucking star. It was the coolest shit that I had ever seen. And the way that I was saying, like, people looking for something that's, like, a little bit more, like, this wasn't indie at all, right? This was a rock band from the South playing the show, right? Like, this is like seeing the Allman Brothers in their prime when you're watching this. And Jason Isbell just slaying through these Dirty South tracks. Like, every single one of the people in that band, all three of the songwriters in that band, at their absolute peak. And everybody in the Bumbershoot crowd being into it. Like, you don't get good crowds at a festival. But that was, like, the coolest. I'm there with Jan, right? Like, it is me and Jan watching Drive-By Truckers, and I still am transfixed in this moment. Like, I saw the Pixies that year. No, this wasn't the year the Pixies played. I think they played the next year. I saw.
No, they were. That was that year.
Okay, I saw the Pixies that year, and to me, the only thing that I really remember about this Bumbershoot strongly was seeing Drive-By Truckers. It will never be. I was like, I'm going to work in live music. That's it. I was watching this and I was like, this is it. This is perfect. They finished the show by playing People Who Died by Jim Carroll. And it was like of Basketball Diaries fame. When they did that, I never heard the song at the time. It was like everybody in the crowd was so into it. And they played People Who Died. And I was just like, it's like, I'm good. I was like, that's kind of perfect. It's so rare to have a moment like that, and to have so, like, these artists playing their best music that they will ever write, excluding nothing, every single one of them, the best music that they will ever write, right after it, just like such a peak. So it's a unique situation. I'm seeing the Pixies 20 years after they've released their best music, right? Like, Jason Isbell in 2012 or 2016 or whatever is still incredible. But like,
I have an important 2004 Bumbershoot question for you. Did you go see Nickelback?
I did not go see Nickelback. No, I was definitely. So the days that I went, looking through this lineup, Friday, September 3rd, the Hometown Throwdown, baby, with there our good friends, the Presidents of the United States of America, headlining Bumbershoot, opening for them, USC, United State of Electronica, and Death Cab for Cutie. And I remember Death Cab opened with The New Year, and I hated that song in 2004. And I was like, I didn't really like Death Cab at all. They had the seats on, like, Memorial Stadium, and I remember just sitting and, like, being like, God, I fucking hate this New Year song. And then, which is the worst song on Transatlanticism, if we're being honest. But I was like, can we just get through this to get to Pusa?
Little did you know that later that year you'd be able to see them in a post-game conference after a Sonics game.
I've seen the Presidents after Mariners games, after Sonics games, at Memorial Stadium, at White River Amphitheater, at what are the N shows? N Fest, I guess.
did you go to? Okay, so what did you see on Saturday then?
I don't think I went on Saturday. Nickelback and Puddle of Mud played, and Seal and Van Hunt. I went to none of it. I saw none of that.
I mean, Seal would be fun.
I don't think I went on Sunday, September 5th either. Hip Hop 1. I love that the shows were named around this time period. Hip Hop 101 with Nas, Public Enemy, Massive Monkeys, and local rapper Birdie, which I also don't think I went to. And then on that Monday, that was when the Pixies headlined. And it was like, I just started getting into around this time period, like especially 80s alternative, and having the Pixies come back. I mean, it was a huge deal at the time having the Pixies play this, you know, like the impact of the Pixies coming back after a couple of decades was massive. And it was also the first of many times that I've seen, and this is no offense to Built to Spill, who I love, but like seeing Built to Spill in situations where I'm like, oh, Built to Spill is playing. Like, unintentionally trying to see, like, you're at the, whatever, KXP holiday party or whatever, and it's like, oh, yeah, Built to Spill's playing. That's cool. Also on this year, I guess I did go, that was Saturday, because I went to go see Nancy Sinatra on that Saturday. So I must have been there. I did not see The Killers on that Monday, September 6th. That might have been opposite Pixies or something on the main stage. But also going again with Jan. I was there with Jan a lot. on the mural stage, which was a pretty small stage, the Black Keys playing. And I remember being in the like concrete area of the front of the mural stage, seeing the Black Keys. I mean, they weren't a big band at the time. Like they were a KXP band. And like I said, that album Rubber Factory had just come out. And I was like, eh, there's this like kind of interesting, like sort of blues throwback band, the Black Keys, who are playing. I was like, I guess I'll go. You know, it really meant nothing to me at the time. I watched it and I was like, that was kind of cool. And then I'm pretty sure that Drive-By Truckers were that same night. I think I went to go see them and went directly to Drive-By Truckers. Wow, My Chemical Romance played. Jesus Christ.
2004.
Right? They played in the Sky Church, My Chemical Romance, to probably maybe 1,000 cap at most. And then, yeah, that's Saturday night. So I went from Black Keys. God, this is kind of wild to think about now. I went from Black Keys at the mural directly to Drive-By Truckers.
That was Bumbershoot 2004.
Man.
I feel like we need to talk about American Idiot, which was such a big album that year.
I've heard like 2 songs from it.
That can't possibly be true.
I've heard
Boulevard of Broken Dreams, legitimately great song.
America, I did not care about. In hindsight, maybe I was wrong, but it was like, this is not what I'm interested. I'm an indie fan now. KXP would not play Green Day.
But this was also in reference to the state of America leading to the election that year.
Uh huh. Do we want to talk about this now?
I mean, let's do it quickly because we're already an hour and a half into this podcast.
Okay.
But
the election 2004, I'd become very political as a 19-year-old, and up the street from our house.
Does it that age?
We live in Boulevard Park, at sort of like the bottom of a big hill. At the top of the big hill, there was a big sign that somebody had put across from Southern Heights Elementary that said "Vote Bush." Do you remember this?
No,
you weren't living there at the time, but this fucking mattered in 2004. This was like. I mean, I hated George Bush more than any human being on earth in 2004. And so they put up this huge sign that said "Vote Bush" at the top of the hill, like very public. And at one point, midnight or something, me and a friend got a Sharpie and wrote "Do Not" on top of it. And then as we're doing this, a car drives by as we're writing this, and they like drive up, roll down their window. This is literally like I was terrified when this happened as if we were doing this extreme act of vandalism, and they rolled down their window and the person was like, "Hey," and we're like, "Oh God, fuck." And she was like, "You need to write that bigger so people can read it." We were like, "Hell yeah, there we go." So that was my act of defiance in 2004. I mean, I remember walking around the day after the election, because I don't know what we anticipated. There probably was a Nate Silver in 2004, but I wasn't paying attention to him.
There was not a Nate Silver in 2004. I can promise you that.
Was it 2008, the first time that Nate Silver, that was like when he really burst onto the scene. but
Nate Silver was busy doing Pakoda in 2004.
Wasting his time. We didn't know what to. You don't, when you don't have polling like this and you don't have access to it, it's kind of just a crapshoot, and you're like, I don't know, we'll see what happens. I've read America the Book, which the Daily Show was also a huge deal in 2004. I think that was the time that it really started taking off.
We would never be surprised by the outcome of an election now. Never would we go into the election thinking that one thing would happen and then something else entirely happens.
Kill me.
Unthinkable.
But I remember that being the date after the election, going to Highline Community College, home of Brian Scalabrine, and just like walking around so depressed. It was one of the darker days that I recall. I think post-election depression is really something. Those are a couple of the days that I remember feeling quite down. So
you're going to feel things after an election, one way or another. Can I talk about the Lil Jon moment now?
Yes.
I mean, Lil Jon. What a time in 2004. So, I can't remember for sure if this was 2004 or 2005. I'd have to I'd have to do some research to try to figure this out. But at one point in this, Lil Jon came to Seattle. I rode up the elevator with him.
Oh my god. Because the Sonics offices, again.
Yep. Because the Sonics offices were in the same building as all the Clear Channel radio stations, who were also owned by Ackerly before I worked there, but for the Sonics, and the team had been sold. And, you know, he, yeah, had the goblet, as I recall it, and then later brought the, some sort of gasoline of Crunk Juice
that said Crunk
to
Juice
the Sonics game.
Was yeah. he friends with Jerome James?
Yes, that was why he came to the Sonics game that night. And so a friend of mine,
legend.
That year I had started doing like these live blogs from games, and early in the season I had used my celebrity sighting of the year on Mario Lopez. And this friend of mine would never let me let it down, the fact that I had used that before Lil Jon showed up at the Sonic
game. You didn't know.
I mean, but that's why you wait to use celebrity sighting of the year.
You have to wait till the end of the year.
Although somehow Mario Lopez, I feel like, is aged better than Lil Jon.
I don't know about that one. He's
like more in the public eye now than Lil Jon.
And you know, people were just,
although he's
got
those commercials,
really wondering. They were waiting with bated breath, like the Oscars on the Supersonics blog celebrity sighting of the year. If you would have said another one, people would have called you on it in the pre-Twitter days.
Wow.
You basically invented Twitter, though, if I'm understanding correctly.
They were a little longer updates than tweets.
These were
more
these were
like
blogs.
This was the first year of the blog.
2004 was the blog year.
I mean, I don't know if it was the blog year. It was the invention of the blog. So part of Lil Jon's fame, the fact that he was parodied on Chappelle's show, which reached its creative peak in season two.
I don't know if this was 2004, 2005. We can just talk about it now, though, because look, we're only an hour and a half into this. We were sitting at Jan's house in Boulevard Park, playing poker, of course, because that's what you do in 2004. And
oh, man, shuts the rounders.
I remember you and our cousin Chris had seen the...
Season 2 was all in 2004. It premiered on January 21st and ended on April 14th.
Okay, that's perfect. Perfect timing. Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories.
Life-changing event. Some of the jokes, which I didn't even get until very recently watching Purple Rain.
About bathing yourselves in the waters of Lake Minnetonka.
Purify yourself
in the waters of Lake Minnetonka.
It was a funny line anyway, but now I understand what the context was.
I mean, the first one with Rick James was like, the cocaine is a hell of a drug. Like,
yeah.
Having... It was the perfect TV moment. Like, if the internet would have existed in 2004, that would have broken the internet.
I'm pretty sure there wasn't internet.
But there was no Twitter. There was no place for us to really talk to each other about it. You would have to go onto message boards.
True.
And in 2004, when you and Chris described Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories with Rick James, and I didn't see it. I think it came out on a Thursday, and we were hanging out on a Friday playing poker, of course.
That sounds correct.
And you said that, and I was like, I have one mission in life, and it is to see this sketch. And I was like, I don't care about any other goals that I have, right? All I need to do is see Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories with Rick James. And eventually did, but it was like, after that moment, Chappelle's show was – it was mandatory viewing. Every single second of every single episode. Because if you miss something, it was like culture existed after that. Like, it was one of those things where if you didn't see it in the moment, you were going to be behind the next day.
I mean, some other stuff from that season. The racial draft.
God.
The quiz show I Know Black People.
Oh, my God.
And then at the end of the season... penultimate episode, the Wayne Brady show.
Wayne Brady, motherfucker. Like, oh my god.
I mean, there has never been a better season of television than season 2 of Chappelle's show.
Wow, you're calling it.
I will say that, yeah.
Wow. And then the Kanye West in common also, on the record B after that.
Yep.
You're probably right. And it holds up to this day. I don't know. I mean, I was watching the True Hollywood Stories with Prince, which is like, it's still perfect.
Yeah, I said that's never going to not be perfect. Also in 2004 in television, the debut of a show that really burst on the scene called Entourage.
Oh, hello.
I tell you, I have never felt like older and out of touch. Last fall, I hung out with Third Feldman Brothers, Zach Whitman and Natalie Weiner, along with one of Natalie's friends.
Does that count as name dropping?
Sure. I made some sort of Entourage reference, and nobody else there had seen Entourage.
Wow, you said you think you want to hug it out, bitches?
I have no idea what the reference was. I was like, and I can't justify enjoying Entourage as much as we did. Like, very few things have aged as poorly within the last 16 years as Entourage has. But still, it was such a phenomenon.
I mean, the steam behind Entourage, so... previously mentioned ex-girlfriend, we would spend hours just sitting in her basement, also in Boulevard Park, and like, they had HBO, we didn't have HBO, and I remember one time, this was way after the season had happened, like, it was probably 2005 that we actually started watching it, and I was like, oh yeah, there's this like weird show, it has the dude from, oh my god, Unhappily Ever After in it. Which is the show that we watched as kids. That's like how I thought of this show.
Yes.
I was like, it has like Jeremy Piven, remember that guy? And the guy from the kid from Unhappily Ever After. I was like, I don't know, let's just watch it. And then like there's the Jane's Addiction theme, and I was pretty into Jane's Addiction in 2004. And I had that, I think it was called Strays off the top of my head, then Jane's Addiction album. And I was like, I don't know, let's just watch it. And then we watched the first episode. And then we watched every other episode that was available because it changed our fucking lives.
I mean, my big memory is Bill Simmons writing about it at the end of the season and talking about that it passed the VCR clock test, that you would look at the clock and see how long was left and be disappointed there wasn't more time.
It really is true. Like that season of Entourage. Okay, so the first season was good and there was a lot of steam. I mean, there's a Gary Busey episode. Like people who shit on Entourage, look. It became a horrible TV show. Like, I do not question that at all. I think after season 4, maybe, it became... yeah, once Ari got fired, and then all the, like, William Morris stuff, once they had that, which, like, most people don't really have, like, a view into what's happening in, like, high-powered, behind-the-scenes Hollywood. And Entourage was a view into that that we'd really never seen before. And, like, for me, the idea of seeing all these people who, like, managers and agents and shit, I was just like, this is the coolest thing that I've ever seen. Right? I was like, I want to do those jobs. Like, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I was like, Ari Gold seems like the coolest fucking person on earth. I was like, he is making shit happen. Right? I'm like, all these other people are secondary, but, like, I'm like the agent, and agent makes shit happen. And then it became a terrible show. So I don't really question that, but, like, I think it was...
And a terrible movie.
Season 5 is where I'm going to say, like, I think it became a horrible show.
But we continue to watch it out of loyalty and inertia.
I think I stopped watching it at some point. But, like... That and then we're not like coming back to Entourage, but the story arc where he's getting Aquaman, I think this was in, so me and that girlfriend had broken up the summer of 2006, right?
Yes. I'm glad I'm here to confirm that for you.
We were, because you're part of this fucking story. We were so consumed by Entourage. It was like destination viewing every single Sunday. Like we would wait all day to watch Entourage, and there was this story arc about Vince getting Aquaman. Like, if this show was on Netflix, I would turn it on tonight and watch it. But I had broken up with that girlfriend after like the first episode of the year, and then you still fucking went to her house and watched the rest of the season. I had no means to watch the season of Entourage, but you went there.
Like, we had our own relationship.
That's what I get for making her sit with Jan for basketball games for an entire fucking year.
Yeah. Yeah. Tournament is fair play, friend.
God, you would be like, oh yeah, crazy Entourage yesterday. And I'm like, okay. I'm going to drink more of this Carlo Rossi.
Apparently not. No, I guess by 2006.
2006, yeah. That's the summer.
It was. The other thing on television that I think needs to be mentioned here, 2004 was the summer of Ken Jennings.
Oh, that was pretty fun.
Which is remarkable because 2020 is also the year of Ken Jennings.
There we go.
Believe it or not, that actually happened in 2020 and not like 5 years ago, the Jeopardy GOAT tournament. Jeopardy was so hot back then.
Yeah, Ken Jennings really, he mattered. I've never really stand Jeopardy in the way. I remember tuning in. I think a lot of us that summer started paying attention because it happened over the summer, right? Where there wasn't like a ton of stuff on. It was really the perfect timing for Ken Jennings to have that run. And I think Survivor debuted over the summer, not that summer, I think previously, but like having things where you can have a moment, especially in the early 2000s, before everything happens all the time now. Like, summer was pretty devoid of television, so having something where...
Entourage, same thing.
I mean, HBO is part of the reason that stuff happens over the summer. Like, but for most people, I feel like the access to HBO has increased a lot over the last couple decades. And, like, those shows, I hear about so much more now. I wasn't hearing about Sopranos or whatever if I didn't have HBO. Like, we had no idea really what was going on. But being able to dominate the summer for something was pretty huge, and I think the timing for Ken Jennings was very incredible.
Okay, before we hit the two-hour mark, let's go to movies, because there were some amazing movies in the summer of 2004, helmed by Anchorman.
Changed our lives.
I don't think there's ever been a single word... Well, I mean, probably if you look at total trivia series, yes, but a single movie that we've ever quoted more than Anchorman.
Yep. It basically invented movie quoting. I mean, other things get quoted. Simpsons is quoted a lot, but as far as movies goes, Anchorman.
And the thing is, I'm not mad.
Yeah, Milk was a bad choice.
No, I'm not mad. I'm proud. Also that summer, Dodgeball, A True Underdog Story. Which, did we watch it in the Tri-Cities with our cousins?
I think we watched it in the Tri-Cities, and then we immediately went and played dodgeball.
Yeah, we had to go buy balls so that we could go play dodgeball at, like, the tennis courts at Hanford High School.
Absolutely.
what an amazing
dodge,
weekend.
Dodge, duck, dip, dive, and dodge. Like, there's no better moment. It's like, I'd already stand Larry Sanders' show, too, so I was like, Rip Torn, that's my guy.
I feel like that was about when I was watching the Larry Sanders Show on the replays that they had on Sunday night
on the CW,
like 11 p.m. on whatever channel that was. 2004, also Mean Girls.
I don't know if I watched that in 2004. Probably the movie that's held up the best of all of these films.
I mean, Anchorman holds up pretty well, but yes, like Mean Girls has become such a cult classic. It's the only one of these we've been to a trivia for, hosted by your former coworker.
For the record, I would go to a trivia for Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
I mean, I watched that recently. I rewatched that for the first time since 2004, 2005, or whenever I actually saw that. Holds up decently, Harold and Kumar.
I've never been to a White Castle. And, like, the only reason that I care about going to White Castle is because of this.
I went to a Crystal in New Orleans during All-Star Weekend 2008 for the same reason.
Oh, what?
That was the Crystal is like the southern version of White Castle. You're looking this up?
No.
You're fact-checking me?
I'm not.
Okay.
But I also want to say about that, I feel like this was the beginning of the NPH moment.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get to that next year.
Is that how HIMYM is 2005?
Himyam is 2005. Okay. Yes. So 2005, a big year in television. And lastly, Napoleon Dynamite, which was, I mean, Anchorman was probably still the biggest of these movies at the time, but Napoleon Dynamite was probably a close second, and it feels like it has completely disappeared from the cultural lexicon now.
that hangs in there. Okay, so I also have
to... I guess there's Uncle Rico references to Gardner Minshew. There is that.
I have to give credit to Arrested Development in 2004, both the end of season and the beginning of season two. Like, Arrested Development, when we watch this, of course, me, not you, because I was about 2 to 15 years ahead of you when it comes to culture, like, watching that show changed the way that we thought about sitcoms. Especially this being on a network and the jokes being so dense and then coming back. It was the first DVD sitcom was Arrested Development. Like,
that's her.
This was not, I remember watching it on Fox and like they would always change the times. It was on like Monday night and Sunday night and it would change around. I think it was on Friday night for a while. And you're like, when is the show on? Like, Fox really did Arrested Development dirty at the time, which it just wasn't ever meant to be a network TV show. But like, once you got the DVDs of season one and season two, you're like, this is fucking brilliant.
Okay, so we're pushing 2 hours, so we don't have time to go into this in too much depth. But the spring of 2004 was also the spring we discovered grilling. Because previously we thought that barbecued hamburgers were terrible.
Yes.
Because Jan would make sure that they were massively overcooked because of her concern about foodborne illnesses.
There's so much food that I thought was bad because Jan was cooking it.
So that spring, it was us, the famous guys in Canada, and our cousin Chris, repeatedly grilling and playing basketball, and specifically a lot of what we called the triple-double, which was two burger patties, two slices of cheese, and... it wasn't really two cut-up hot dogs.
It was a hot dog, but you cut it in half, so it looked like two.
Right.
I think we'd also have bacon in there, too, though.
Oh, that is true. Two slices of bacon. Correct. What a moment.
God, is it so much to ask to have a fucking time machine and go back to 2004?
It doesn't seem like that much to ask.
We weren't even drinking at the time. That's the thing that I think was wild. Like, we were barbecuing constantly, but we weren't even...
There was a lot of drinking Dr. Bolt.
We would drink soda. Like,
Doctor, give me the news parody involving Dr. Bolt.
We would just, basically every single day, Chris would come down from UW, he was a freshman, I guess, come down to Boulevard Park. We would go and play basketball for an hour or 2 hours. And then grill and then play poker. And, like, why is that not my life right now?
Because of your 10 to 15 children. That's
God, the answer. I need to be telling them about this life and be like, look, I know you're 3 years old. But this is the peak of life. Look, we're going to reach the peak on April 16th. It is playing basketball, barbecuing, and then watching Chappelle's show. Life is not going to get better than this. Oh, and then you're going to turn on the best indie rock record you've ever heard in your entire life.
Should we talk about 2020?
I miss you. 2004? Oh. I think 2005 was a good year. I don't know, man. 2006 I remember is the best summer of my entire life, but I think 2004 really might be up there with my favorite years I've ever lived.
Yeah, I agree.
And 2020 is up there with my least favorite years I've ever lived.
Again, number one for me because of the pandemic that is happening. It's costing people their lives, sadly.
Number one worst. You're saying?
Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying. When I cite the pandemic, that's not a pro. That's a con. So some updates on Seattle sports in 2020. We didn't mention this last week. The WNBA draft... The WNBA announced last week will be held remotely on Friday, April 17th. The Storm holds the number 11 overall pick in that one.
Yeah.
So there'll be the first draft going a week ahead of the NFL draft the following week, which we learned today will be done exclusively
on Slack.
Remote. UW men's basketball, a lot of comings and goings. Last week, center Isaiah Stewart declared for the draft and said he has plans to sign with the Rock Nation agency.
Oh.
No surprise there.
For people who are following agency signings.
Point guard Elijah Hardy placed his name in the transfer portal. He told Percy Allen, "I'm just trying to figure out what's the best fit for me. Washington is not out of the question, but I'm trying to figure out who's going to give me the best opportunity to get to the next level," which I gotta say, is kind of optimistic for Elijah Hardy.
What next level is he referring to?
And possibly related news, Nate Pryor, who originally committed to UW out of West Seattle High School in 2017 before spending a year at a prep school and then ending up at North Idaho Junior College due to academic eligibility issues, after decommitting a few weeks ago, has now recommitted to UW. So Pryor is primarily a point guard and could kind of replace Hardy's spot on the roster if he does in fact transfer.
Cool.
So there you go.
Where is Nate Hardy considered? Like
Nate Pryor. He was a late. He had previously signed with Seattle U before flipping to UW after Hopkins arrived, and that recruiting class was kind of broken up after Romar's departure.
How many years ago did he come into UW? Jesus.
3 years ago.
Okay. Cool.
So we still haven't heard on Jaden McDaniels, also no word on Naz Carter. And Percy did mention in that article that Quade Green is expected to return.
Okay, good. Why have we not heard about Jaden McDaniels? Is it because we expect him back or the uncertainty? Is he?
I think there's no rush to declare for the draft right now. The date for that, it's definitely later in April. He's got a few weeks at the very least.
I mean, the draft is almost certainly not happening when it's scheduled to happen.
Actually, I would say at this point it's more likely to happen when it's scheduled to happen.
Really? Because you don't think the NBA season is going to happen?
It seems increasingly unlikely that an NBA season will happen.
Really? There was chatter around... God, that's... I know this is stupid because I shouldn't care about billionaires, but like...
The amount of money that would be withheld from their paychecks?
No, the Clippers. I'm just like, you fucking went all in on this year, and it's just gone. I mean, same for the Lakers, too. Like, this was going to be their championship year.
Yeah, I think it's probably worse for if we're doing, like, a power rankings of who's hurt the most if there's not a playoffs. I think Bucks are probably number one because they don't get a chance to show Giannis that they can get to the finals before he has to decide on the Supermax extension. Lakers number two, and of that group, Clippers a distant number three.
Really? Even though they only signed Kawhi and Paul George to two-year deals?
Yeah, but they're still going to be really effing good in year two. Also, like, why are they? What better situation are they going to find than playing for the Clippers in Los Angeles, which is their... Both of them are from Southern California. Like, they can't go to the Lakers at this point. Where are they going to go that's going to be better? I don't think that's a big deal.
Okay. You're not buying that. But it just feels like...
I mean, that to me was like, they can sign for a lot more money in 2 years. Like, that was a factor in it.
We'll see, but yes.
Kawhi specifically.
Yeah. Salary cap may decrease by a huge amount, but yes.
But either way, he'll be able to make a higher percentage of the cap then. And then point two, just to give yourself an out in case things like go disastrously bad. And obviously they have not gone disastrously
bad. They canceled the entire season.
Not because the Clippers weren't playing well. Not because they lost one game to the Lakers at the end of April 26th is the official date by which players have to declare. So Jaden McDaniel still has 3 weeks.
Almost. I mean, we should anticipate that Jaden will declare. The Lakers, because I mean, do any of them benefit because of having a huge chunk of rest for sort of players that might be injured or older?
I don't think among the group of legit contenders now.
Oh, you don't think like PG getting back to 100%? It's interesting, or
he was already pretty damn good. I mean. The hamstring has plenty of time to heal now. I guess that's good. But
okay.
I don't think it's a big deal.
Well, okay. That's interesting information.
Let's wrap up with the Seahawks, who notably last week waived safety Tedrick Thompson and tight end Ed Dixon, saving a combined $5.1 million in their non-guaranteed base salaries. Both players were entering final seasons of their contracts, so no accelerated cap hit from their bonuses, and both waived with the failed physical designation.
RIP to the Tedrick Thompson era.
what an era it was.
Ed Dixon barely played, but I remember there's one or two solid catches.
Yeah, he had some good moments in the 2018 season. Couldn't get healthy last year, which is a bummer. And after the Greg Olsen addition, even before the Greg Olsen addition, seemed like a fait accompli that he would be waived. The Seahawks brought back Benson Mayoa.
There we go.
Second former edge rusher coming back, joining Bruce Irvin on a reported one-year, $3 million contract. You'll recall that Mayoa made the Seahawks as an undrafted rookie in 2013, playing two games. Has played for three teams since, including the Raiders twice, where he was most recently. Had a career-high seven sacks for them in just 302 snaps, but that was almost certainly a lucky total. His QB hits and pressures were similar to 2018 when he had just four sacks in 550 snaps in Arizona.
And the dollar amount, that's the... I just love NFL teams and their perspectives.
How so?
Why are they able to accurately assess that this was, with the Mayo contract, that this was not necessarily demonstrative of his ability? Are pass rushers just not getting paid this offseason? Is that the deal?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, look, Jadeveon Clowney is still getting offered a lot of money. It's just not as much as he thinks he's worth, and he probably is worth, but, you know... Benson Mayoa is still getting, you know, I'm sure these offers are at least 5 to 6 times as much to Clowney, and the waiting game just continues.
Hey, Clowney. If the Seahawks were to re-sign Clowney at this point, got themselves a pretty good offseason here.
You certainly feel good about what they've done with the pass rush. So the indication, I think, that my ESPN colleague Brady Henderson wrote about this is that Irvin... I don't know if it's weak side or strong side. Whatever the other one linebacker is that only plays in base defense on early downs and then play defensive end on clear pass rush situations. So you've got some depth at your pass rush if you do either bring back Clowney or, you know, I think they'll still look to probably re-sign Everson Griffin from Minnesota if they lose Clowney.
So Everson Griffin is just out there.
He's waiting for Clowney.
Waiting for Clowney.
Like it's like wherever Clowney doesn't go, that's where Everson Griffin is going.
I'm going to be optimistic here and say with Clowney, you look at that pass rush, and it doesn't look bad. I mean, it's maybe not near the top of the league, but there's quite a bit of depth there. There's still some potential young talent players who can emerge. And
I mean, I don't think that the fact that the Seahawks went out and signed Irvin and Mayoa is a great indicator of what they're expecting from LJ Collier in 2020.
But there's another player in the mix. And look, maybe sure. He'll get lucky and break out. But like both of those two plus a high-end pass rusher, now you've got yourself a little pass rush.
So the other thing we should talk about here is that we got contract details for both Philip Dorsett and Jermaine Effetti. Who both signed identical contracts, as I understand it.
Pretty wild identical contracts.
One-year minimum deals. Jermaine Effetti, the Seahawks starting right tackle last year, signed a one-year minimum deal, while George Fant, their backup left tackle, signed a three-year $30 million deal.
A little bit more versatile.
Apparently Effetti is versatile because he's swinging into right guard for the Bears. At this price point, I gotta say, I think the Seahawks probably should have kept Jermaine Effetti. I mean, you know, it's different.
He wasn't available. He was not available to sign in the Seahawks at the minimum.
But the fact that they're giving Cedric Ogboihe twice as much guaranteed money as Jermaine Effetti got is pretty ridiculous.
I mean, it's a wild thing to consider skill-wise, but, like, it's one of those things, humanity-wise, where you can't – this is the difference between – real life in a video game, you can't release Jermaine Effetti and then just decline his fifth year option and then re-sign him for the minimum.
I think it's more like if you're going to take that kind of massive pay cut, you're more likely to do it with another team than with your current team, because the whole idea is you want to prove your value is greater, and how can you do that with the same situation?
Yeah, it's tainted at this point. Like there was basically no chance once we got here of Jermaine Effetti re-signing with the Seahawks, and I wish him the best in Chicago.
Me too. It's also, like I said last week, it's a pretty huge indictment of the fact that he continues to start for the Seahawks his entire tenure here, if that's what the market thinks of him.
I don't think you would look at – I don't know exactly – I don't think you would look at the advanced stats and say that he's a minimum offensive lineman.
Probably not. But again, the league valued him that way, and the Seahawks valued him as their unquestioned starting right tackle for several years.
I don't know if they valued him as their unquestioned starting right tackle, but he was there.
I mean, they weren't going out and acquiring someone to compete with him.
It happened this offseason.
the someone to compete with him?
Yeah.
Sure.
I think that the offensive line will be better next year.
But also, Philip Dorsett at the minimum.
It's a steal.
Really good about that value.
Oh, yeah. I mean, getting an experienced NFL wide receiver at the minimum is like, sure, what the hell? Why not?
Yeah. And like we said last week, at that price point, it doesn't preclude you from drafting your receiver out of this year's
absolutely
great
not.
Class.
The idea that they would go into the season if they valued receiver as a position that they needed and say, like, well, we've got Philip Dorsett, I don't think that's the case. It feels like the market this year, and maybe this is a byproduct of the offseason happening during coronavirus, or maybe it would have happened either way, but it feels like there was a bit of a market right away and then it just bottomed out instantly. Right? Like that third tier, there's basically no market for whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with Kwani, but yeah, it definitely, like, you wanted to sign the first day or two.
And wide receivers in particular, I think were pretty undervalued. How the NFL assigns values to positions is insane to me.
Well, I think that probably is a factor of the deep receiving class in the draft.
And maybe that's the case, but like, this is still very good value for Philip Dorsett. Whether there's a deep receiving class
or
not, he'll be playing next year on the Seahawks. And they got an experienced wide receiver for the minimum. It's a steal.
Yeah.
So I definitely commend Schneid's on the offseason. Look, maybe Bill Barnwell would have given...
Assuming the Seahawks re-sign Clowney. That's still a pretty big F.
Well, I mean, I want to see the news every day that they've re-signed Clowney. If they sign Everson Griffin for a lower amount or less of a commitment, it's still not a bad offseason, I don't think. And either way, they've probably called Clowney on his bluff, no matter what.
I mean, I guess. I don't know that you get any credit for that if you don't take advantage of it.
Yes. But the way that the market is borne out, I just really don't think it's predictable from year to year what positions the NFL is going to value, because I feel like it's kind of random.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Where there was a year, I think this was two off seasons ago, where it was like nobody wants safeties anymore, and then last year
right,
it was like
that's,
safeties
well,
are getting
Seahawks
paid.
Got McDougal.
Yeah, but and then it was like everybody wants safeties last year, and you're just like, how do NFL teams determine this? It feels like just if one player signs, all of a sudden, in the same way wide receivers this year, like nobody was signing wide receivers at first. And it's like, has the NFL stopped passing the ball? Maybe literally nobody will be passing the ball this year. But
well, that's true.
They're still signing other positions, and they're not going to be playing either. So, you know.
On that note.
We wish Jermaine Fetti all the best.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.